today, 96-1618 Sierra State v. Ronald Jackson. Marguerite Moeller, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, representing the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner, State of Wisconsin. This matter is here on the state's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 2, which reversed the defendant's convictions for first-degree sexual assault, armed burglary, kidnapping while armed, threats to injure, and first-degree sexual assault. The events giving rise to these convictions arose out of an incident which occurred December 1st, 1994, in Kenosha. All of the charges involved the same victim, a young woman named Kelly H., who shared a residence with the defendant and the defendant's girlfriend, Jennifer Anderson. The Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, reversed Jackson's convictions on two separate grounds. First, the court found that the trial court should have permitted the defense to present evidence of prior consensual sex between himself and the victim after the prosecutor cross-examined Jackson about the victim's ostensible motive for falsely accusing him. Secondly, the court found that the trial court had erroneously exercised its discretion and violated the defendant's right to a fair trial when it allowed the prosecutor, in cross-examining Kelly Anderson, who was the younger sister of the defendant's girlfriend, to use threatening language that was contained in a letter the defendant had written to Jennifer Anderson. On both of these issues, Judge Brown of the Court of Appeals dissented. With respect to the first issue, Judge Brown found that the prosecutor had not opened the door to the previously excluded evidence, and that even if the prosecutor inadvertently did so, that keeping out the evidence did not deprive Jackson of the right to present a defense. On the second issue, Judge Brown found that the evidence from the letter should not have come in, but that in light of the substantial physical evidence corroborating the victim's testimony, that any error was harmless under State versus Dias. Naturally, I would like to address both of these issues, but unless the court has other plans, I'd like to briefly address the first issue and concentrate more of my argument on the question of the admissibility of language that was contained in one of the letters the defendant had written. With respect to the evidence the defendant wanted to get in, that he allegedly had consensual sex with Kelly H. on three prior occasions.
Don't we have to accept that as true for the purposes of this case?
I think
you used the word alleged. You put emphasis
right,
on
it. Right. I guess I want to say that the prosecutor, the victim, and from my point of view, we don't agree that this ever occurred. But I think in light of the way the trial court analyzed it and the fact that the victim herself did not testify, that you're correct, that you have to assume that he met his burden, at least, under State versus DeSantis, under that first threshold for getting the evidence in. But I don't want to make any admissions that this, in fact, happened, because I think that's our goal. All members of the Court of Appeals agreed that the trial court's initial ruling was a correct exercise of its discretion in keeping out the evidence, because there was really no showing that these prior instances of consensual sex were material to any issue in the case. The first time that the defense ever in writing indicated that it wanted to get in this evidence was in a pretrial motion filed on the Friday before trial started. And at that point, the defense indicated these incidents would be relevant on the issue of consent and to show that there couldn't be kidnapping because she was voluntarily with the defendant in the apartment. But when trial rolled around 3 days later, consent was no longer an issue because the defense was saying, our defense is that this sexual assault, these crimes, never occurred. There was no sexual contact on December 1st, 1994.
Was there any DNA evidence in this case?
No, there was not. There were never any samples taken from the victim, and as far as I'm aware, nothing was taken physically from the blood stains that were.
Isn't the bias or motive of a witness always an issue in a case?
Yes, it is. But the problem here was that there was never any nexus made between this alleged consensual sex and any kind of motive to falsify sexual jealousy. The trial court...
But isn't that really a question for the jury to decide, counsel? That, I mean, if I'm sitting on the jury, I may say, hey, come on. You know, you're stretching it to say that this is a wronged lover kind of thing. But nevertheless, isn't that appropriate to allow the defendant to put that in and allow the jury to do with it as they wish?
Not
I mean, the statute does not speak to... we've said that it's okay on the issue of consent.
Correct.
But we have not ruled, as far as I know, that it's on other issues. And what we're asked to decide here is, okay, on the issue of bias or motive, can it come in?
The state certainly isn't arguing that in the appropriate case, this kind of evidence could not come in to show sexual jealousy or bias.
So why is it not appropriate here?
Because here, there was absolutely no evidence put in by the defendant, even though he was given ample opportunity in this pretrial offer of proof, to show that there was any connection between these three...
What could he have shown other than the fact that there was possible bias or motive? The wrong lover. What could he have shown?
I think he could have shown statements that might have been made by the victim about trying to get even with him or attempts on her part to pursue a relationship even after they stopped having sexual relations. I think he could have called other people who might have been aware of the sexual relationship to indicate that she had made this kind
of
comments.
That might have been good, but that means none of that might have been available. Why came just from the fact of this prior sexual relationship, why can't an inference be made by a jury? I mean, you just have to raise reasonable doubt. You don't have to, the defendant doesn't have to prove it.
Correct, but I don't think that was a reasonable inference on these facts, because by virtue of the defendant's own affidavit, the last time the two of them ever had sex was back in August of 1994. This was supposedly a very clandestine kind of affair. And the charges did not arise until December of 1994. And in the period between August and December, all the evidence indicated that this victim was completely annoyed with the defendant for reasons totally unrelated to having had any kind of a sexual relationship with him. In addition, she was in a long-term relationship with a man for 4.5 years. They were very close, had just vacationed together in Canada at the time that these charges arose. And under the circumstances, it simply didn't make any sense to suggest that just because they might have had this very brief tryst, that somehow this motivated her to change what the defendant claimed was a simple shoving match down the stairs into a gruesome and lengthy sexual assault, which also involved robbery and kidnapping.
The trial court here, at the pretrial hearing, said that there was no nexus, if
you will. Correct.
Essentially, it said that there was no showing that it was material, that the first prong of the two-prong test on material and probative value. The questions asked thus far suggest to me kind of a blanket rule of whenever there is prior sexual relationships with the complaining witness and the defendant, between those two. And even if consent is not an issue, as in this case, that there need be no articulation of materiality because it can be inferred by its nature. As I understood the trial court's ruling, and the trial court pressed the defense counsel, you know, show me why it's material, show me why it's material, and there wasn't much of a showing. But what's wrong with a blanket rule saying you don't have to articulate materiality as long as there is pre-existing sexual relationships between the defendant and complaining witness? we can infer materiality without any being articulated by the defense. What's wrong with that?
I think it's wrong because I think it completely ignores the legislative mandate in 972.11, I believe it's 2B, which says that even those three categories of evidence which can come in despite the rape shield law still have to be shown by a pretrial motion to be material to a fact at issue in the case and of sufficient probative value that it exceeds their inflammatory and prejudicial nature.
Are you done answering?
Not quite. Oh.
Okay.
And as Professor Blinka points out, when you look at 972.11 sub 2b, you have a presumption against admitting this kind of evidence as opposed to the normal balancing test that you would use under 904.03, where as long as the probative value is about the same as prejudicial effect, then it comes in. So if we were to have a blanket rule saying any time the defendant and the victim had previously had consensual sex, that comes in, then there wouldn't be any need to revert back to this balancing test and to require there to be a finding by the trial court that it's material to a fact at issue and that the probative value exceeds the prejudicial and inflammatory nature. Justice Babbage?
What if we change the facts a bit? Because you did make reference to the fact that this was a very short relationship. I think there were three incidents. What if we had a three-year consensual relationship which was cut off? And then a few months later, 4 or 5 months later, an allegation of rape without any of the other statements. Would that make a difference?
I think it could well make a difference in the trial court's evaluation of whether or not it should come in. But I think that once again, because you're looking at this from the viewpoint of a reviewing court, asking whether the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion, depending on whether the trial court found that the probative value of the evidence, for example, was not greater than...
If I could interrupt, counsel, I'm not comfortable with hinging this on an erroneous exercise of discretion here, because as Justice Bradley suggested, what is being suggested by some of the questions, I don't know if we agree with it or not, but I don't even know if I agree with my own question, but what is being suggested is that as a matter of law, there would be a principle that... when consent is not, and therefore
you're saying
there would
it's a constitutional matter, then?
Not necessarily as a matter of law, however, and therefore the failure to allow this in was an erroneous exercise of discretion.
I don't think that necessarily, because two people had had consensual sex for 3 years and then it was cut off, would always come in mm-hmm. in a situation like this. I think that certainly makes it more amenable to admissibility than the facts we have here. But I don't think that there should necessarily be a hard and fast rule, especially when you've got a situation, in this case, where the defendant himself, when asked by his attorney, who was obviously trying to get the client to say the right thing, said, "What did you perceive the reason for the fight to be, apart from the money?" And he said, "That was it. That was all there was." It was really a matter of trial counsel, who apparently either was not being told by his client until the last minute what the defense really was going to be, because here you have it 3 days before trial, he's saying the defense is going to be consent, and now you get to, 3 days later, now the defense is something else. The trial attorney was kind of left, as you can tell by the offers of proof he made, at a loss to say why this evidence was material. I mean, first, he basically gave kind of a State versus Shilkut response and said, it was important for the jury to know this just so they could understand the complete relationship between the parties. He said nothing about any kind of a sexual motivation or jealousy on the part of Miss H towards the defendant and Jennifer Anderson. Said nothing about that. And the trial court wasn't ignorant of the fact that he was trying to make this kind of offer of proof. The trial court said, look, there really hasn't been any showing that there was sexual jealousy, that she was biased because of this. You just haven't made that showing. But the trial court also went on and said that any probative value of the evidence was outweighed by its inflammatory and prejudicial nature. And I think that goes without saying, because if the jury were to hear these accusations, it would paint the victim as somebody who not only was being unfaithful to this boyfriend of 4.5 years, but also being disloyal to her friend since high school, her roommate, by having sex with her boyfriend and fiancé. So I think the, you know, inflammatory nature of this evidence would have been great, and the probative value was really very low, especially when, if they had allowed the defense to put it on, Miss H would have gotten on the stand and absolutely denied that any of this occurred. So then you'd have the jury involved in a, once again, a credibility battle, not only over the facts underlying the charges, but also on whether there was really this prior consensual sex. So I think that reduces the probative value from the situation where you've got, as you posited in your hypothetical, an acknowledged 3-year prior consensual relationship. That makes it a lot more probative where you're acknowledging the fact and where it's long-term. Where you're not acknowledging it, and it supposedly happened 3 isolated times, ending months before the charged offense, I think the probative value is very low.
Ms. Miller, let's move on to the question of opening the door.
Before we do, under 11, material means relevant.
Well, material actually has to be something that is at issue in the case, and I think
that's relevant.
Correct.
What's the difference between
I think materiality means, is this issue at all part of the case? And then relevancy is more, does this actually prove what you're trying to say that it does? That's my understanding. Although the terms are often used, I think, interchangeably.
Your position then is relevance or materiality in the balance are issues of discretion.
That's correct. That the first part of the DeSantis test, I think, is more of a question of law, and the second two are really discretionary determinations of the trial court. The second issue in this case is, Justice Crooks, do you have a question right off the bat on that second issue?
I just wanted you to get a chance to articulate your position in regard to whether or not the prosecutor had opened the door here by his questions in regard to motive.
No, the prosecutor absolutely did not open the door. The defense, in its opening statement, had already alluded to the fact that their defense was going to be that this was just a little fight they had about money, and that the victim exaggerated it into saying that a weapon was used because she was angry at the defendant, wanted to get him out of the house. The defense had also called Kelly Anderson before Mr. Jackson ever testified to create the inference that the reason Kelly H. was accusing him was because she was mad about $50 owed to her for a phone bill. She was mad about the fact she had to front the rent on the apartment on several occasions, and he was living there rent-free. And in addition, Mr. Jackson was asked by his attorney on direct about the monetary aspects. So when the prosecutor asked this question, all he was really doing was kind of summarizing what had already been said by the defense in its opening and through its witnesses. Contrary to what the Court of Appeals found, the prosecutor did not dart from motive to motive and chart into some kind of unexplored territory. The only motive the prosecutor mentioned up to that point was saying, well, you're giving us here for the motive for why she wants to falsely accuse you is because of a financial disagreement. And that was an accurate statement of what the defense position was. I saw nothing wrong with the prosecutor asking this question, and it was clear that he was taken aback when the defendant came back with a response, well, there was more to it than that, issues that I'm not allowed to go into. Prosecutor immediately retreated and basically said, well, you're just saying that this woman has it in for you, right? He agreed with that, and then he said, and one of the motives you're giving us is this financial one. So I don't think there was any door opening. The second issue revolves around letters that the defendant had written to his girlfriend, Jennifer Anderson. And I think this issue is more factually and legally complex than the first issue presented. First, because although these two letters appear in the appendix to the defendant's brief in chief, and they were admitted into evidence, in fact, the only excerpts from the letters that the jury really heard were, first of all, references that the defendant made using the words bitch and pussy in one of the letters, and that came in, and the defense never on appeal objected to this very limited use of the letters. That was never raised as a claim of error by the defendant on appeal. Then, during the cross-examination of Kelly Anderson, the prosecutor was allowed to read in 5, which I will admit are inflammatory, statements made by the defendant in one of the letters, the letter that's, I believe, S-39, dated June 19th of 1995. five of those statements into the jury and cross-examining her to show that this 16-year-old girl was a biased witness. She had a motive to lie because those statements to any reasonable person would be viewed as threats. And yet she was minimizing it and saying, oh, those are just examples of Ron goofing around, just being his usual, you know, humorous self. And also to show that the defendant had, in fact, made threats to the victim's sister. The sister had, in turn, shown this letter to the witness. She had read the letter before trial. It wasn't something the prosecutor sprung on her. And how would this have an impact on a 16-year-old girl? I think a logical person would say that I better testify the way Ron wants me to, or I better say he's a good guy because he's made threats to my sister. So the prosecutor used five statements in cross-examining Kelly Anderson. He tried to get them in through Jennifer Anderson's direct but adverse examination. Trial court said, no, we don't need them here because it's clear that she's got reasons to be biased. I mean, she's his fiance, she's been his girlfriend for a long time. But the trial court did allow limited use of the letter.
But so then how do you account for the prosecutor's closing arguments when he stressed the character of that these statements were exemplified the character of the defendant?
I think that those statements were very close to crossing the line, that he should have used them not in the way he did in saying this shows the essence of who he was, but to limiting them to explain the letters do give a reason for what motivated him to commit this kind of offense. And even though the trial court disallowed them for this purpose, when the prosecutor got into his closing argument, and this was a very heated case, I think it's obvious from the record here, it was extremely emotional on the part of both attorneys. There was never any objection made at that point to his statements. I don't know exactly why this was, if this use was so improper, but there was never any objection made. So the prosecutor went on, and I think the thrust of his argument really was that these letters show that this is the kind of guy who doesn't take being put in his place by a woman very, you know, nicely. And that's what Kelly H. was doing when she kept arguing about the money, that she was telling him, hey, you got to pay me back, you owe me money, and he was drawing an analogy there. I don't sanction what the prosecutor did insofar that it sidestepped what the trial court had said the admissible reason for the letters was. I don't sanction that, but I think if there had been an appropriate objection made, the trial court would have had a chance to evaluate this. But there never was any objection. There was never a motion for a new trial based on either prosecutorial misconduct or ineffective assistance based on a failure to object. So I don't think that just because the prosecutor utilized these letters in that fashion, that violated Mr. Jackson's right to a fair trial.
Counsel, I didn't read that part of the transcript that dealt with the admissibility of these letters. They're clearly hearsay, and through this witness, what was the basis of the ruling that they could be admissible under what hearsay exception?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily offering them for the truth of the matter asserted, because
they were being offered for what?
Well, I mean, I don't think that they were. I think they were offered to show that Kelly Anderson, having read these letters, thinks that they don't constitute threatening language. I mean, even the defendant said most reasonable people would view these as threats. And I think the jury would kind of wonder why this 16-year-old girl was willing to go to bat for this guy.
Is that what the record shows? I mean, why a letter, out-of-court statement, you know, classic hearsay, through this witness, is that what the record shows why they were admissible? I couldn't figure that out.
Well, I mean, I think that the record shows that the prosecutor tried to get him in for a lot of different reasons, but the only reason the trial court, I believe, allowed them in was to use in cross-examining this witness to show her bias and to show whether or not she, in fact, felt threatened by this language.
Yeah, but what caused them to be admissible? I mean, under what rule were they admissible? Under what legal rationale?
You mean it's an exception to the hearsay bar?
Yeah.
To show this, I don't think that they're being admitted for the truth of the matter asserted.
So even if they were, aren't they the defendant's statements?
They were, right, they were his own statements.
He's a party, isn't he?
Yeah. So that's true, they'd be a party opponent.
So let me ask you about the sort of the foundation for this cross-examination. Chief, can I continue? I see your red light's on. Part of the argument on your first issue is that there's an insufficient foundation to show sort of the nexus between the alleged consensual sexual relationship and the motive to lie. Here, all we had, as I understand, at least from the briefs, and I've not read the full transcript, the prosecutor asked the witness whether she had been threatened. She said no, and there's no evidence that, in fact, she had been threatened, right?
I don't know if the there never was ever a predicate actually presented, but the prosecutor seemed to suggest by his questioning that maybe he talked to the mother or something because he was saying something to the effect of...
But there's nothing in the record that she received any threats.
No,
and then she sort of volunteered that it's obvious she kind of thought he was getting to the letters because she sort of brought up the letters and said, you know, characterized them as fooling around. And it seems to me that the prosecutor then tried to use, sort of said, well, that she kind of opened the door to let him go into the letters because I don't see him ever saying, aren't you afraid of the defendant? Don't you have some fear? I mean, she was never asked any of those questions. She was asked whether she'd been threatened, and she said no. And so it seemed to me he sort of bootstrapped these letters then by virtue of her having mentioned that these letters were simply meaningful. And it seems to me that the nexus isn't here either between the question and the purpose that you claim that the prosecutor was using them for.
Well, I think it's actually twofold. It's not just a motive in the sense of, okay, you're threatened because you know that this person has made these comments to your sister, but also the idea of bias. I mean, if you were a 16-year-old girl and your older sister showed you a letter like this and... Right before, in fact, the timing of the letters was very interesting because...
Let me ask you that. Then why doesn't he ask that question? Did you read some letters, and did that affect you? You know, he never asked those foundational questions. He just went into reading the letters so that the jury could hear the words.
Right. I mean, I don't know why he didn't. I mean, I'd like to think that if I were a prosecutor, I would have asked those questions because the date of the letter that she read was the same day that the trial was supposed to start. The trial was originally set for June 19th. I found it... The timing is rather suspicious that this letter is dated the same day that the trial was supposed to start, and that's when the sister shows her the letter. And this girl is saying, oh, I don't think these statements are threatening. I think that shows her bias, that she's minimizing the kind of behavior that this defendant...
I may explore this with you later, but your red light's on, and we're using your time, so...
Sorry.
Just to clarify one thing, you said you were going to spend more time on the second issue. What is the second issue? Is it that the state opened the door, or is it relating to
the second
letters?
Issue was relating to the letters, and what I wanted
I
to get into...
I just wanted to clarify that.
...was the whole idea of the harmless error.
Thank you. Mr. Cushing.
May it please the court. My name is Glenn Cushing. I appear here today on behalf of Ronald Jackson, who was originally the defendant and appellant and is now the respondent in this court. I guess I'll start with the, since we finished with the issue concerning the letters, I'll start there. I do want to, in case there's any confusion about this, there's no claim that this letter was inadmissible on hearsay ground. The letter was a statement of the defendant, and therefore it is admissible. I would agree also that it really wasn't offered to prove the truth of the matter in those letters. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why I'm here, is because I believe those letters were offered basically to smear the defendant's character, to place in front of the jury evidence of his violent and domineering character. And that clearly is improper. And I think the record, if you read the record, the whole series of events that led to the admission of these letters, the language from these letters, it's clear that the prosecutor's purpose was to try and show that the defendant was a domineering, violent individual who treated women in this fashion, women in general, and therefore used that to convince the jury that this was a basis upon which they could convict him of this assault, which he was denying. It's clear that some of the language, and I won't repeat it here, it's in my brief, it's clearly inflammatory. I don't believe that the state would claim otherwise. That language was somewhat threatening. There's no doubt about it. What's interesting, of course, is that it wasn't directed to the witness. It was used to impeach. Kelly Anderson was the younger sister of Jennifer Anderson. It's clear from when Jennifer Anderson testified, and I think it should also be clear that Jennifer Anderson was called as a witness by the state. She was not called at this trial by the defendant. She testified as the state's witness. I believe primarily so that the prosecutor could try and show that no efforts were made to turn in Mr. Jackson during the brief period of time he was at liberty after this alleged assault occurred, and that she knew his whereabouts and didn't turn him in. And so she was a state's witness. And during the course of her examination, her direct examination, the prosecutor attempted to impeach her with the language from this letter. And the judge would not allow it. And if the judge had simply stuck with that ruling throughout this case, I think we wouldn't have this problem. He clearly ruled, and I think correctly, that those letters were some threatening language in those letters, but they had to do with the personal relationship between Mr. Jackson and Ms. Anderson, who was his fiancée. He was incarcerated at the time, awaiting trial. Apparently, there was some information that come back to him that Ms. Anderson may not have been 100% loyal to him while he was in jail, and he was expressing some displeasure about that to her. The judge, this was all brought up at the time that the prosecutor tried to use it to impeach Jennifer Anderson, and the judge ruled that it couldn't come in, that it was not related to her testimony at trial, was not an attempt by Mr. Jackson to influence her testimony. It was related to matters outside the trial, which would result in all kinds of other extraneous evidence coming in, exploring their relationship. And so he said, no, you can't use these letters for that purpose. But the prosecutor just wouldn't let go of this and clearly wanted this language in. He wanted the jury to be aware of what kind of a person the defendant was, more than whether he actually committed this crime. And so he tried it again when Kelly Anderson was testifying. And at that point, he finally became successful, and I'm not really clear why. I'm not really clear as to what the distinction was. If this evidence was not admissible to impeach Jennifer Anderson, to whom the letters were addressed, mailed, sent, they weren't admissible to impeach her, why they would be admissible to impeach her younger sister, to whom she just showed the letters.
Well, didn't she testify that the letters were non-threatening?
She did.
They admitted the language of the letters to show that she mischaracterized them.
Well, I suppose so, but that seems to be just bootstrapping, as Justice Geske pointed out. I mean, the whole way that this questioning came up, the prosecutor asked her, he apparently asked her if she had been threatened. She said no. There's no evidence that she was. And then it turned to whether she considered the language in these letters threatening. And in my opinion, that question itself, it provides a bootstrap to later get it in. He asked the witness, do you consider that threatening? She says no. So he immediately...
Was there an objection to the question?
Not at that point there wasn't. There were numerous objections every time he tried to get the actual language in. And I could read briefly some of the cross question.
Would you read, if you have it there, just how Kelly Anderson brought up these letters? I think that's what I'd like to hear.
Because she was the one who
used the word bootstrapping, but Kelly Anderson brought the letters up and then characterized those letters as just fooling around. And then I think, why wouldn't the prosecutor, after she brought the letters up, have the opportunity to discuss what fooling around meant?
I guess I don't have it directly in front of me. I have in the state's brief, on page 32 of the state's brief, against this backdrop, the prosecutor asked whether the witness had ever received threats from the defendant. In responding, that she and her mother had a discussion of threats. The witness brought up the letters. This is her testimony from the transcript. Quote, we talked about the letters that Ron had written, and I told my mother that he just fooled around, that he doesn't mean it.
But I guess the
problem I have with this is, even given this discussion, the language from the letters is so inflammatory, and its probative value so little, that just to use this to somehow, just because Kelly Anderson, who's a 16-year-old girl, brings this up during her testimony, to allow this as the basis for admitting this evidence seems to me to be extremely prejudicial to the defendant and of very little probative value.
But the commentary, we read, the full letters are in are in our material here. A very small portion. In fact, the most prejudicial and inflammatory parts of the letters I don't even think were used. They only used the portion that may have been to deal with what she said, non-threatening or fooling around. I mean, the letters that referred to the relationship you discussed, I mean, that portion was not used, and that language was not used.
I agree, except that the threatening language that they took out was as a result of his anger over his fiancée maybe having a relationship with someone else. And I certainly, although those letters, the full letters are in my brief, they weren't submitted to the jury, and I think clearly if the complete letters had been, the state would probably be confessing error.
I understand but that's what I'm saying.
But the language that was used, I don't think anyone could characterize it as non-inflammatory or prejudicial. I mean, it clearly, I don't really want to read it, but it's in my brief, and I don't think there's going to be a lot of argument that it's very inflammatory. The fact that there was more inflammatory evidence that wasn't brought in doesn't really resolve the question as to whether, despite the manner in which this arose, what was the prosecutor really trying to do with this? And the suggestion is that somehow he was trying to impeach Kelly Anderson. But I don't think that's true. And I think if you read the record carefully, you'll see that he wasn't trying to impeach Kelly Anderson.
He wasn't trying to show that she was biased in favor of the defendant by saying that there were no threats in these letters?
I don't believe so. I think what he was trying to show was that the defendant was a threatening individual. And if you read his cross of Kelly when it comes to that, it isn't, were you threatened? Were you scared of the defendant? Isn't it true that you're testifying here today on his behalf because you're afraid of him? Those really weren't the kinds of questions he asked. The questions were more like, and these letters contain threatening language. No, not
now,
really.
Mr. Cushing, I'm reading from 202 of the record.
Okay, I don't have it right in front of me.
This is the record number 30. Question. Did you receive any threats from Mr. Jackson? I mean, is this the part of the record we're all talking about?
Yeah, I believe
okay.
So.
Question.
Yes.
Did you receive any threats from Mr. Jackson? Answer, no. Question. Did you ever communicate to anybody that you received threats from Mr. Jackson? Answer, no. Question. You never made mention of that to your mother? Answer, no. Not from me, no. Question. You never had a discussion about threats with your mother? Answer. We have had a discussion of threats, but you never threatened me. Okay? Question. What was the discussion about then? Fitzgerald. That's counsel, right, for the defendant?
Yes.
I'm going to reject this based on hearsay, court overruled. We talked about the letters that Ron had written, and I told her that he just fools around and he doesn't mean it. So we've now moved away from threats to her to the letters.
Correct.
And then the question then goes on, are you familiar with the letters? And then there's a whole series of questions, and they wind up, is that a typical letter? And then Fitzgerald then objects. It's irrelevant. Court, I'm going to overrule. She's explaining a position that she's had and discussions she's had concerning either threats or concerning communications from the defendant. Then she goes on, and then it goes, and they contain threatening language, and she says, no, not really.
Correct.
So he starts out asking about threats to her, and he winds up with the letters.
Correct.
Threats to the sister.
Yes. And then, if you go on, you see that he then moves on to the fact that they were directed to his sister on 204. He keeps going on. But not all of his letters are threatening. Question. That's an answer. Question. Some of them have been. Answer. Like one or two. Question. Then he returns to the sister, directed to your sister, Jennifer. Yeah, but they were not threats. And then he moves on the next page. The defendant, he's really just a nice guy, right? Answer, yes. Question, treats your sister real well. Answer, yes. Question, makes these kinds of statements to her in the letters. Answer, he's just fooling around. Question, isn't it fair to say that based upon your contacts with Mr. Jackson, your sister and yourself, that you've observed Mr. Jackson trying to exercise control over your sister? Answer, no. Question, he hasn't tried to intimidate her or threaten her into doing things. Answer, no. And so what he's done is to take the cross and move it away from Kelly and back to, isn't it true that these letters show that the defendant's a threatening, domineering person who treats your sister poorly?
Counsel, well,
I guess my point was that if one feared for one's sister, that's what the state seems to be talking about, that could have a impression or make a difference as far as this sister's or testimony. Isn't that
right? I suppose so. It's just that the record, it never really comes out. He doesn't establish that. There's no, when he begins the whole questioning about threats, there's no evidentiary basis for it in the record. That he, when he starts down that whole road that eventually allows him to get in the language he wants, there was no evidentiary basis for it. He just comes out of the blue, isn't it true the defendant threatened you? And we have no evidence of that, no foundation for that question to begin with. The end result of this whole process is that he gets in this inflammatory language, which he then uses in his closing, directly contrary to the ruling the judge made, to argue basically propensity evidence. He basically argues that the defendant is acting in accordance with his character.
Does he ever argue that Kelly was intimidated, and that's why she testified the way she did?
I think there is a brief reference in his closing, and I don't have it right in front of me. But yes, he tried to use it both ways. He tried to argue that Kelly would have been intimidated by these letters, although, again, there's no evidence of that. There's simply, she denied it. He had the language, so he can argue the inference that she must have been intimidated.
Can you tell us, if this was improperly admitted, why it is not harmless error in light of all the evidence against your client?
Well, I don't think that the evidence in this case can be characterized as overwhelming, number one. First, we've got basically a credibility question. We have no witnesses other than the complainant and the defendant. Diametrically opposed testimony, although he did admit to a fight, a physical struggle with her. So if you just start there, basically the case is he said, she said, no eyewitnesses, nothing to actually corroborate what she said. There is some physical evidence that's corroborative of her version of these events. I'm not going to stand here and deny that. But the question becomes whether that is so overwhelming that we can overlook the prejudicial aspect of this evidence. First of all, the blood, there was some blood in various spots in the apartment. It's clear that she was scratched and or injured in some fashion. The defendant admitted that they had a physical struggle, admittedly a brief one, but there is testimony from him that he scratched her face. He may have scratched her face. He may have punched her. They fell down the stairs. He testified that there may have been some, he may have scratched her. She may have cut herself on the banister. There are other explanations that might account for some of this blood. Even if you accept that the blood corroborates that there was some kind of a physical struggle between the two of them, the defendant admitted to that. That does not establish a sexual assault.
Then the police found a paring knife, I believe, later on after when they searched the apartment.
Correct. And there's some weakness there, too, because they didn't find that knife when they originally searched for it. They didn't find it until the next day when they came back to search a second time. They searched her bedroom immediately upon being called. They could not find this alleged knife. And the room was apparently a mess. There are photos, I don't know if they're in this record, the photos of her injuries are in the record. There's clearly a scratch on her arm. Those things left the blood. Although, again, I would also point out that the blood was never tested by the crime lab. It was never, I believe it was collected, one of the technicians ran some kind of immediate presumptive test that came back positive for blood. But it was never taken to the crime lab. It was never established whose blood it was, what type of blood it was.
Mr. Cushing, the fact of the blood stains on the washer and dryer, isn't that quite significant in this case, given the story that each one told?
Well, it certainly contradicts the defendant's testimony that they weren't in the basement. However, I think it leaves open the possibility that the defendant, while admitting that there was a physical confrontation between the two of them, may have downplayed the extent of that. And we don't really know. Again, the blood, I would still take the position that the existence of the blood corroborates perhaps the physical confrontation between the two. But but he was convicted of multiple crimes here, and the blood does not corroborate that he committed all of these crimes. Maybe they were in the basement. It doesn't necessarily corroborate that there was a sexual assault.
But how can you square that with her not telling the police? She's telling the police initially she didn't know her attacker. I mean, if this theory is that she's making up this sexual assault to get the defendant, and she reports a sexual assault and says she doesn't know her attacker, and it's not until later that she said, yeah, I did know him, it was the defendant. I mean, that doesn't seem to fit.
Well, it doesn't necessarily fit completely there. I don't know. Obviously, she was afraid immediately afterwards. There was some kind of a confrontation between the two of them, I believe. The defendant admitted it was a physical fight, punching, scratching, you know, scratched her face. So there's not a claim here that everything that happened was
completely... But is there any reasonable explanation why she would report a sexual assault and not name the defendant if, in fact, there had been no sexual assault?
No. I suppose it could be argued that it's consistent with our claim that it was fabricated, that the defendant...
That's really... I mean, that this was all part of the conspiracy, that she was first going to say she didn't know who it was and then later on claim it was him?
Well, I agree. It doesn't fit completely. It's not 100% consistent there. But the harmless error issue, it's not, is there sufficient evidence to convict him, or is there some evidence that convict him? I've never claimed that the evidence was insufficient. The question is it so overwhelming that this court can claim that this error with the letters was de minimis? And I think the court should keep in mind that all three of the judges in the Court of Appeals found the admission of these letters and the prosecutor's use of them during his closing to be error. And I think contrary to the way the state characterized Judge Brown's harmless error analysis, his analysis was not, this is harmless because it was overwhelming evidence. I'm not sure what Judge Brown was thinking, but if you read his footnote, and it's in a footnote where he, mostly his dissent focuses on the first issue about the consensual sex being admissible. He put in a footnote that, oh yeah, by the way, I agree that it was error to let in these letters, but it was harmless, and the reason it was harmless, according to him, is because, well, yeah, it definitely hurt the defendant's credibility. It impeached his credibility, but I don't care about that because all I care about is the victim's credibility. And it didn't impeach the complainant's credibility. It didn't bolster the complainant's credibility. So therefore, it doesn't matter. And I find that reasoning very unsatisfactory. He clearly recognized the error. He recognized that it hurt the defendant's credibility. And once you get to that point, I think, unless you're going to state that the evidence is overwhelming to guilt, then you have to find that error requires reversal. So I don't believe it's fair to characterize his discussion of harmless error as being based on his belief that the evidence was overwhelming.
Counsel?
Yes?
I would like to return to the issue of the prior sexual conduct. As I read the briefs and the portions of the records that were excerpted in the briefs, it suggested that the pretrial hearing, the court specifically asked counsel, well, how is this material? I'm getting to the nexus or the materiality of this prior sexual conduct. And that there wasn't much of an answer given, some kind of a general answer, as indicated by your opposing counsel. Then, as referenced in page 5 of the dissent, it suggests that when the question was asked by the state, the trial court interrupted the proceedings at that stage to determine if Jackson, now during the trial, when the there is this allegation the state opened the door, to determine if Jackson could make an offer of proof to support his new position. Jackson could not. It suggests to me that although perhaps an argument, and a good argument, could be made that this is material, that prior sexual conduct is material to motive, that twice being given the opportunity, explicitly asked by the court, that there was no response by the defense in the record showing what the nexus is.
Well, he said it was relative to her, relevant to her motive. Those are his words.
How is it relevant?
It's relevant because it shows, and this gets back to my primary issue, which is that it should have been relevant from the beginning. It's relevant to show her bias and her motives to fabricate this story.
So is it your position that in all cases where there is prior sexual contact between the defendant and the complaining witness, even though consent may not be an issue, that it's relevant? Without the need to show in the record specifically why it's material.
Well, although I believe that I might be able to make that argument, that's not my position here today.
Okay,
and I did have, when this came up earlier, I meant to address this, that I'm not arguing here for a blanket rule that it's always admissible. I think that argument could be made. And I believe that the reason that argument could be made is because bias, which always comes back to the relationship between the witness and the party, bias is always relevant. It's never collateral. So that the law has for many, many years, common law, forever recognized the right of a party to show his relationship to the witness in order that the jury can evaluate the witness's testimony. The law recognizes the slanting effect upon human testimony of the emotions or feelings of the witness toward the party.
But you're not making that argument, so...
You're not making it in also...
I'm making that argument as the reason that it was relevant in this case. I'm not trying to argue here in this case that it should always be relevant, because I don't believe I have to.
So where is the...
Well, I believe the evidence is just in the record. I don't believe, as Justice Babbage pointed out, that you can require a defendant to have to present an admission from the complainant, that you have to have a statement from her. Well, I was mad at him because he broke up with me and he was sleeping with my roommate while we were all three living together. I mean, you have to look at the facts of this case. These three people were living together in the same apartment. The defendant's girlfriend and fiancé was the roommate of the complainant. Now the defendant has had an intimate, consensual relationship with the complainant while he's living with his girlfriend. He then, according to his testimony, breaks off this relationship with the complainant so that his girlfriend won't find out. Presumably, he's now having...
That goes to your common sense argument.
Yeah,
I understand that, but I
don't know that there's that much more to it.
But that sounds awfully lot like a blanket rule to me. You know, this kind of a situation, it takes common sense, and so therefore you don't need the showing of materiality as required by the statute.
Well, I believe that is a showing of materiality. Bias is always relevant. You should always be able to show that the witness's relationship to the defendant in order to be able to argue, in order to have the foundation to argue to the jury that she was mad at me because I broke off this relationship and began to sleep with my girlfriend.
Now, but this is a counsel having a firm grasp of the obvious. The obvious in your argument in the blanket rule will be, and if this becomes standard fare and the Rape Shield Act or law is no, this is a would be a broadening, that would be just a common defense. It won't always be used. And here, you have the denial of the victim, I didn't do it, but that doesn't make any difference. As long as the allegation is there, then the jury, whether it's material, would always hear that, and I cannot...
Well, I guess I'm not sure that it would always be material. I'm saying it,
well,
if you had a consensual relationship that was 5 years old and you had moved to a different state and you hadn't seen this person for 5 years and you weren't... I mean, there are some specific facts in this case where all three people are living together in a very close environment that I think would allow the court to, if it chooses to do so, to recognize its materiality in this case and not in every case.
What were the dates of the alleged sexual contacts?
Well, they were in July, I believe.
July and August?
It was when she moved in, and it was June, July, and August of 94. The allegation, the incident allegedly occurred on December 1 of 94. So we can call it months, we can call it 90 days. From, you know, or 100 days from the middle of August to the 1st of December. And I do want to point out a couple of things the court should keep in mind. This evidence is not barred by the Rape Shield statute. This evidence is specifically admissible under the Rape Shield statute.
Under one of the exceptions.
Yes.
Yep.
It's a conduct between the complainant and the defendant. So we don't have all those issues. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, that really this is admissible if relevant. It's not, we're not overcoming the rape shield bar here. There is no rape shield statute bar to this evidence.
You agree?
It's very different. Excuse me. I was just going to say it's very different than just trying to smear the complainant with allegations of her sex with other men. I mean, this was done for a very limited purpose. It wasn't done to smear her character. And this court has recognized in Pulizano, this court recognized, and I'm quoting from that decision, 155 was second at 644, the exceptions enumerated in the statute are those limited circumstances in which evidence of a complainant's prior sexual conduct is generally viewed as probative of a material issue without being overly prejudicial.
Let me ask you now, I'm going to interrupt you. It's admissible under the rape shield law inasmuch as the trial court is required under 97131, which is the section of motions before trial, to do the balancing of sufficient probative value to outweigh inflammatory and prejudicial nature, right?
I mean,
that, and so it is clearly a trial court discretionary call.
It is, except that it impinges on the defendant's right to defend himself, to cross-examine, and to present evidence. It stops being a discretionary issue, and it becomes an issue of constitutional law, which this court reviews de novo.
But, well,
and that's in Pulizano. Because you deprive the defendant of the right to present critical evidence in his own defense.
But that sort of begs the question, because it's only critical if, in fact, it's probative.
If it's relevant.
If it's probative value outweighs it.
Correct.
I mean, it's still the balancing test, and so it still ultimately has to be the underpinnings of this is a trial court assessing what worth this is to the defendant versus the prejudicial effect.
That's true. But in this court, I believe that I can firmly state that review is de novo of this issue of whether or not the ruling deprived the defendant of the right to present critical evidence to confront the witnesses against
him. And how do you determine how critical is it? Is it not the weighing process of the probative value versus...
I agree with that. But if the court finds the evidence relevant to bias and a motive to fabricate, then I think that absent some compelling state interest to exclude this evidence, the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense trumps any kind of a discretionary ruling that we want to keep it out. That's what
and
happened.
The probative value is just the fact that, in fact, at least in the trial court's mind, there was a sexual relationship in the summer, and therefore it's admissible to show that she may be fabricating now.
Yes, and I do want to point out just briefly, if I can, before I close, that because it's been stated that in the original offer of proof, there was no reference to this being relevant to sexual jealousy, and that is not true. Almost the very first statement that defense counsel made in his offer of proof was that this evidence would be relevant and material to showing probable or possible sexual jealousy on behalf of the complainant.
Can I ask one more question? Does it say on the record, and maybe I missed this, but does it say on the record what caused the breakup or what happened when this relationship stopped?
Well, it doesn't say what happened. The defendant testified that he ended the relationship because he did not want his girlfriend.
Did he testify to that?
Yes, either in the offer. Yeah, it must have been in the offer.
Did he testify as to her reaction at the ending of the relationship?
No.
So there's no evidence that she flew into a rage or said, I'll get you, or, I mean, there's absolutely...
There is no evidence of that. And of course, it's my position that you can't require the defendant to have evidence of that, because the...
But he didn't testify to her physically react, I mean, even without a statement, it's just, the only testimony is, I ended the relationship, and that is the basis for which you believe that it's admissible to show that she fabricated... 6 months later.
Yes, and her bias, her relationship to him.
Okay.
And I would just conclude by asking the court to affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing. Ms. Moeller.
I'd like to address briefly the question of harmless error with respect to admission of the language in the letters, because this is something I didn't get to talk about during my original presentation. I think it's really an understatement to say that the physical evidence just somewhat, you know, corroborates the victim's version of what happened here. I think if you look at the physical evidence, it is so corroborative of the victim's testimony that you can't say under State versus Dias that there's any reasonable probability that the jury's exposure to limited language from the letters affected its verdicts on any of the charges, because how they evaluate that physical evidence could not have been influenced by what was contained in the letters. The letters had nothing to do with the physical evidence. And that physical evidence included discovering a knife on the floor in the victim's bedroom. The victim testified that the defendant threatened her with a knife through portions of the assault. Mr. Jackson said no weapon was involved. Bloodstains were found on the clothes that Kelly H. had been wearing that night, on her turtleneck, on her brassiere. Bloodstains were found on the washer and dryer in the basement. Bloodstains were found near a light switch on the wall that led from, I believe, the kitchen to the basement area. Even though the defendant at all times said they never went into the basement, according to him, what happened was a scuffle or tussle that took place primarily right outside her bedroom door and down the stairs in the apartment that they shared. According to him, they did not go down the basement. Kelly H.'s injuries, as were depicted in photographs taken within 1 hour of the assault, including a large cut on her hand where she claimed she was slashed by the knife, and she still had the scar to show to the jury apparently at the time of trial. There was also a curtain that normally covered the window and the front door of the residence they shared. That had been ripped down. She claimed that she grabbed that in an effort to get away from Mr. Jackson during the assault, but that he grabbed her by the hair and kept her inside. The police officers who showed up at the scene said that the victim was extremely distraught, crying, shaking, and that she at first would not tell them who her assailant was. After they conducted a search of the residence and assured her that her assailant was no longer present, then she said that it was Ronald Jackson. Now, certainly if the defense theory was that she was framing him because she wanted him to get out of the apartment, there's no good reason why when the police arrived, she wouldn't have said, Ronald Jackson.